Right, we're continuing our study on the one and the many, and tonight we're going to look at the state. When we talk about government in our modern world, the first thing that comes to mind is civil government, or the federal government, some state legislature. But as R.J. Rushdoony pointed out in his book, This Independent Republic, in the history of the United States, this was not the first thought that came to the minds of Americans when you said government. To their minds came the idea of self-government, and closely associated with that was family government. Those are the things that would have come to their mind. And then they would have distinguished government by saying civil government if they were applying to the state. So family is the primary form of government upon which all other forms of government are dependent. And it's only when the family government and the self-government, and the self-government is very dependent upon family government in many ways, is the training of children, the instructing of them in righteousness. And so you see that the family plays the central key or the central role to having people turn their hearts to submit to God's government in all areas of life, whether it's the church or the state. So when we think about it in this way, when we think what is primary and what is central, it helps us keep civil government in its place. But having said that, civil government is also important, and we need to get to grips with it if we're going to glorify God in what we do in that realm. So it has a vital role to play in the working of God's kingdom, and thus our thoughts about it, as with all areas of life, must be biblical. Now, people have struggled throughout the history of the world to formulate a system of civil government that knew how to handle the one and the many. How do you preserve and protect the body, the one nation? How do you keep it intact and strengthen it without oppressing the individuals that make up the nation? Well, how do you give the freedom to the individuals without destroying the possibility and the existence of being a body and a nation? So those tensions have existed throughout time and continue to exist in our day. And we see that people's answers to those real-life tensions that they experience are not always conducive to the thing they profess they're trying to attain. Plato, one of the greatest thinkers in the history of the world from a humanistic perspective, he really was a brilliant man. He said that the individuals are responsible to the state and not the state to the citizen. That's why he was trying to solve the one and the many. He said, okay, no, I understand we've got both these, but this is how we have to solve this problem. The state was said to be the ultimate order, which meant that the state had to be preserved at all costs. So if there came an issue between the one and the many, if it was, well, what about the unity of the state or the individuals within the state, if ever that became an issue, it was determined by the rulers. So you had the elite guys in charge of the one, the body. They would determine, okay, what should be done here? What should be worked out? They were the highest law, so they would make the law and determine, okay, what do we do in this situation? So this made the rulers the ultimate lawmakers, and therefore the embodiment of law. So you want to say, well, where does our law come from? There it comes from. It's Plato's idea. It comes from the rulers, the elite leaders, because they're the ones there who are there to preserve the state, and everything else exists in order to preserve and keep the state. So the rulers basically are the ultimate lawmakers, and therefore they are the embodiment of law. Now, it all sounds very familiar to our day. That's where we look to for our law. When people are saying we're going to make a law, we say, oh, well, we look to Congress. We have nothing higher or more ultimate than them. It's interesting. For Plato, utopia, you know what utopia is? It's the idea of paradise, in a sense. But for Plato, utopia was not material possessions. Was not everybody having material wealth, which is what a lot of people have as their utopia today. You know, we'll all be rich, we'll all have no lack of anything. That's the utopia we're working towards. They kind of think the state is going to produce that. But for Plato, in his Republic, the book he wrote on civil government, basically, he said that utopia was not everybody having material wealth, but basically it referred to the total government by the elite. When you've got total government by the elite leaders over the whole nation, that's utopia. Because these people know what is best for the people. These people have the authority to make the laws, and they bring it to pass. That's utopia. So the goal is to get to that position. And Plato, in his later years in life, wrote another book on laws. Because fundamentally, he didn't believe there should be a law code. Because the elite rulers were the guys who would make these laws as need arose. And so they would make them. So, but later on he said that we need a stepping stone before we get to the ultimate. It's almost like Marx, you know, these stepping stones to arriving at the utopian goal. But we need the laws until the people are matured enough so that the elite leaders can make these laws. Rushdoony covers that in his book, The One and the Many. So this was Plato's and Socrates' answer to the problem of the one and the many. They understood this issue about the one and the many and formulated this answer in order to solve it, because they were confronted by it, and they knew each philosopher that thought about this issue was confronted by it. So they wanted to protect the state by the elite rulers, and thus maintaining the unity or the oneness, and the state or republic needed no legal code, because these elite leaders would make the code that was necessary. These protectors, their goal was to free their people from oppression of foreign nations. Okay, so that's what they do. These elite leaders were protectors. They would protect their nation from foreign nations. That was the idea. And thus, they needed to protect and free their people from the oppression of other nations. But this didn't mean that the individuals within their nation were free, because the goal was only to have a free state, not a free people. We don't want freedom for the people, we want freedom for the one. The many, it doesn't really matter. So that's really was how they were solving this issue. And thus the individuals in the state were necessarily free if the state was free. So you see, individuals only became masters of themselves when their elite rulers governed them totally and prevented the base nature of man from exerting itself. If your elite rulers could truly govern every detail of your life and prevent you from manifesting your foolishness and base nature, then you were a free, mature person. And that's what mastering yourself was, when you were mastered by the elite rulers. So you see, the one, the answer to this one in the many was clearly the one has dominance. So thus liberty is being totally governed by ideas of the elite rulers. The many are absorbed into the one, and the only significance that the many have is found in their relationship to the one. They have no meaning other than in this relationship to the state. The true care and well-being of the individual is the care and the well-being of the state. Thus the one is the source of law and the source of education, that it might preserve itself. It's the source of all these things in order to preserve its oneness. Now, anarchy is a real and great philosophical problem, and the philosophers realized this, and they needed to deal with this threat of anarchy. But without knowing the triune nature of God, they were unable to protect both the one and the many, and thus they sided with the one. However, the inevitable oppression of the one against the many created revolutions and anarchy, and the destruction of the union, which merely proved the point that you needed the one to keep control of the many. And so you have this vicious cycle throughout history. Now we know as believers the only solution to the one and the many in the civil realm is the doctrine of the Trinity, where both the one and the many are shown to be equally ultimate. The only way we know the doctrine of the Trinity is through revelation, because we cannot know who God is unless He reveals Himself. And so as God reveals Himself, we see that He reveals Himself as the triune God. And the Trinity shows us who God is. We didn't come up with our own images and definitions of who God is on our own, according to our own minds. The only way that we can be sure that we are worshipping the true God is if our thoughts about Him and the way of relating to Him is in terms of His revelation about Himself. This is how you must think about me. I'm going to tell you who I am so that you know how to think about me. So He has told us who He is, what He likes, what He hates, what He's doing, and on for this purpose. So God has ordained it that we were utterly dependent upon every word from His mouth. And this is not merely for some areas of our existence, but every area. And to know the doctrine of the Trinity, this becomes vital, that we submit to every word from His mouth. So the doctrine of the Trinity is the starting place of true religion and the glory of the Christian faith, for it reveals the nature of God. However, in revealing the essence of God's nature in this way, we are taught a valuable lesson. We're taught about how truth about all things is attained. And as we look at the Trinity and we realize, okay, how do I arrive at true knowledge of God? Well, I've got to understand Him in His triune nature. But the only way to arrive at this triune understanding of God is seeing it in the comprehensive flow of the whole of Scripture. The whole of Scripture lays it out, because there's no one passage that we turn to that says, there, I've proved the Trinity for you. It's as God reveals Himself throughout the whole of Scripture, and as we're reading this throughout the whole of Scripture, by the time we get to the end of Scripture, we realize, this is a triune God whom I serve. And in doing that, He's revealing to us also that His comprehensive word is the basis for everything we understand, and that's how we are to approach every subject, is everything that God has said on it, in order to be sure that we understand that truth properly. So this doctrine depends upon the absolute truth of all that God has revealed about Himself. The Scriptures have to be both infallible and authoritative if the doctrine of the Trinity is going to stand. You can't have a wishy-washy Scriptures and believe in the doctrine of the Trinity, because man's wisdom is going to amend these funny verses that seem to point to, well, who's being talked here? God seems to be mentioning we. When he's talking about we, who could he be referring to? Oh, we've got to amend the text. And so you've got critical commentators who are doing that all the time, and they change the text in order to bring God into man's parameters of who man thinks God should be. So unless we have an infallible, authoritative word, the doctrine will not stand. Without the verbal inspiration of the Bible, we have no basis for believing in the Trinity, and thus we have no basis of relationship with God. So you can see this doctrine of the Trinity that is assaulted from many angles is fundamental to every aspect of our living. And unless we understand it in that light, we cannot have relationship with God. That's why the Athanasian Creed declares, unless we believe in this doctrine of the Trinity, you cannot be saved. Because you cannot be related to God, you cannot have relationship with Him, you cannot do anything that He has called you to do unless you understand Him as the triune God. So the way we come to understand the doctrine of the Trinity is the way we have to seek and understand every part of our existence. So by being utterly dependent upon God's revelation. God has revealed His nature and character to us so that we might properly relate to Him and do His whole will. Scripture is the ultimate revelation showing us how we ought to think about everything, not only about God, but about life and the church and the civil government and all these aspects of life. And the way we arrive at God's will in mind for how we are to think about and act in relationship to all these areas is by pulling everything He has revealed about it in the whole of Scripture. We've got to pull that together and say, okay, now I understand. I understand what civil government is. I understand what church government is. I understand all these different areas. God has revealed all that we need to know, as 2 Timothy 3:16 and 17 says, a common verse. All Scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God may be complete, thoroughly equipped for every good work. Thus, when we come to that application of the one and the many to the state, we have to take the whole of God's revelation about the duties and the boundaries of the state, along with everything that God has said about the responsibilities of the individual. So we've got to take it all together and see where those lines are. We're not to come up with a vague generalization that God has granted authority to the state to punish evil, and then upon that general statement, build all the details according to man's wisdom. Okay, so we know the state is to punish evil, so what does that look like? So whatever the state defines as evil becomes evil. Now you say, no, God doesn't give that amount of liberty and authority to the state to do that. It says, it not only lays down the general principle, you are responsible to do this, it also says, this is how you're going to do it in these situations and cases. It is by knowing who God is that we know how we ought to live. But we neither know who God is nor how we ought to live if we don't embrace the whole of God's revelation as authoritative. The nation is important because it has a specific purpose and function in the outworking of God's kingdom plan. So the nation has a vital role to play in the whole of God's plan. You wouldn't think so today by the way the church gives such scant attention to the state. However, the state's responsibilities are defined by the same revelation that brought it into existence in the first place. It's God who gives the state existence, but it is God also who gives the state its boundaries and parameters as to how it ought to exist. The state, the one, is meant to protect the life and the property of the individual. Thus God has granted the state the sword, according to Romans 13 verse 4, so that it may execute wrath upon those who do evil. Okay, so I want you to protect these people's life, I want you to protect their property, and I give you the sword so that you can do that. So it's not left up to the state to determine what evil is, because the state is to be God's minister, serving in their capacity for God's glory. The state is given authority to protect itself and the individuals that make up the whole state. However, all its actions are meant to be grounded upon God's revelation. So as Plato believed that the preservation of the one trumped the many, God's revelation shows the equal ultimacy of both the state and the people. And when we embrace the comprehensive nature of God's revelation, then we'll be protected from the foolish decisions that choose the one over the many or the many over the one. An individual has the right to voluntarily sacrifice himself for the preservation of the one. You can do that. I'm going to sacrifice myself for the nation on my own terms. You've also got to be bound before God, as before your conscience, but the individual can sacrifice himself to protect the one on those terms. But the one does not have the authority to violate God's standard of ethics in order to preserve itself. So, for example, a foreign nation comes that is much stronger than your nation and says, give us Mark. Give us Mark or we're going to overrun you. And we say, let's let Mark pay the price for us because let's let one man die rather than all of us. And so we hand him over. We don't have authority to hand him over. We don't have authority to hand an innocent man over to some kind of judgment. So at that point, we have to say, no, I'm sorry, there's higher principles involved. The one's responsibility is to protect the many, and Mark is part of the many, and therefore we are going to stand on justice and truth and defend him as we would defend ourselves. And that's our responsibility, as opposed to saying, well, let's be pragmatic and let him pay the price. Biblical ethics does not allow the life of an innocent person to be taken or the innocent to be punished. So what does justice look like in the face of this kind of request? So we've just explained, that's what justice looks like. Now we have to stand and fight, because this would be immoral. It's only God's law word, however, that can define what's right and wrong, and what's just and unjust. And so although we've got this idea of the one and the many, we still need the whole of God's counsel, the whole of his law word, to show us, okay, well, where are the lines, where are the parameters where each one ought to function? Can the one decide on the case of Mark, well, let's hand him over because we're preserving the many in this way? No, you can't. Were they bound by the parameters that God has revealed? What are your responsibilities? What are the guidelines that have to keep you functioning within certain channels? And it's only the word that can show us what the relationships are between the one and the many. And it is only as we bow to the whole of God's comprehensive revelation that we'll be able to know where the responsibilities begin and end for the one and the many. The only way the one and the many can be held as equally ultimate in the civil realm is because God has given a comprehensive revelation showing what he expects from each. And so many times we try and separate the one and the many from the comprehensive revelation God has given. It's God's law that makes it possible for the one and the many, in every area of life, to exist together and mutually support rather than destroy each other. The correct application of the one and the many cannot be done if God also didn't reveal the boundaries and responsibilities for each one. So when we say that the one and the many are equally ultimate, this doesn't mean that they both carry the same weight in every situation. They don't. There are some times where the one carries more weight than the many and vice versa. But how do we know when that situation is? Has to be the law of God that shows us that. So what it means is that they're both equally important as they function within the parameters God has defined. And those who deny the comprehensive nature of God's law word for today ultimately will have the one oppressing the many or the many destroying the one, because man in his own wisdom is incapable of determining what is the best for society or best for the individual or what is just in this particular situation. So God reveals what specific justice looks like. And it's never justice for some at the expense of others. We are never expected to opt for something whereby we allow injustice for the lesser number so that the greater number might get justice. That's how the world functions all the time. Well, we're trying to do the best here for the greater number. So as soon as you buy into that idea of the greater good, you've bought into a lie. Because you're saying the greater good of what? And it's always at the expense of some other people. Somebody is paying the price for the greater good, so-called greater good, and it isn't, as Bill said, it's never the greater good. It's actually oppressive. When the murderer is executed, this is justice. It's justice in the state for the whole nation as a body. It's justice for the victim and the victim's family. And it's also justice for the person who is executed. He's received justice, and he needed to receive justice. No one is being sinned against when justice is truly carried out. When the murderer is not executed, it is injustice for the state, for God's wrath rests upon the people as a body. It is injustice for the victim and their family. And it is not justice when the murderer is given any other kind of punishment. That's not justice either. That's injustice. And this applies to every area. You could bring up many different areas. And in our day, it's the poor. That's the big area where we're going to make justice. And it's not just that so-and-so is making so much money. We've got to take from him and distribute it to those who don't have. But how does the one help the many who are in need, the many poor? How does the one help the many, the unity, the state, the nation? How does he truly help the poor? Now we know he can't commit injustice. He can't make justice out of something that is unjust to others. So he can't say, no, this is not just because I've taken money from you and given it to the poor. My action wasn't unjust. So he can't do that. So how truly does the nation help the poor? Okay, providing opportunity to work. So you want a free economy. You want a free situation where the state is not infringing into the labor market, dictating and manipulating prices and controls in that kind of way. It's through charity. That's how the state should do it. So I want to make situations conducive where people can make a lot of money, including the Bill Gates and the Warren Buffetts of the world. Let them make this money. And these men, despite being taxed exorbitant amounts, still give exorbitant amounts to charity, which belies the whole fact that the state is afraid of. If people have a lot of money, they'll be selfish, they're not going to share. But allow the charity to come from individuals who freely give and sacrifice of their own in order to help those who don't have. We have to bow to those boundaries and the responsibilities that God has laid out in His law for all these areas. So we want to protect the work ethic, we want to have a free market, we want charity to flourish. That's how the poor are truly helped, as well as the reduced close evaluation upon those who you are helping, where there's accountability. And it's not just a blank check that is given out. Nobody knows the character of the person that's receiving the check. And so there's accountability on that side. That's the only way to truly help the poor. But there we've got the nation, the one now saying, okay, we've got to help the poor. And then looking at the parameters that God has set up and saying, okay, I have no authority to be involved in this area of redistribution of wealth. I have no authority. So by doing that, I'm not helping the poor. I'm acting unjustly. One in five families are on food stamps. And what we're seeing is when the state steps in to deal with trying to help the poor, they just increase, they exacerbate the problem and increase the poor and make generational families of welfare mindset individuals. So you're stealing from the one person, because that's what it is. It's by force. It's by the threat of gun that they're going to take money from one group of people and spread it around to another group of people. So the state has no authority to steal our money. And that's what they're doing. It's just a Robin Hood tactic. Stealing from the rich to give to the poor. And it needs to be seen in those terms. It is theft. But then the state also, what about when the state says, okay, we're going to get involved in public education? So, okay, well, let me look at the parameters again. Let me see what God has given, the parameters. I know I'm the one, I know I'm concerned about the many, I know I want the best for the many. And God says, okay, but I'm defining for you what is the best for the many, what you can do toward that end, and what you aren't supposed to do, because there are other mechanisms in society that will come in and do that. But when you've got an overbearing state taking a responsibility, also once again, with the power of a gun, through the barrel of a gun, you like to use that with the Marxists, they take this jurisdiction with the barrel of a gun and say, okay, we have monopoly, you're all accountable to do it in this way. We see that it spirals and destroys the very thing they claim to be trying to build. So the public school system is as much a leech on the system as your green stamps. Why does the one, in our context of the modern state, want to control education? It's said for in the name of, well, we want to give everybody an equal opportunity. But that's not the real reason. If that was all it was, they would just say, who wants to educate, come and educate, we'll just pay the salaries of the teachers. Teach them what you want, however you want to run it, that's fine, we're just going to help, we're just going to pour money in there. They're trying to brainwash the citizen. They're trying to get the citizen thinking in a way that supports the one, the elite rulers. So the elite rulers, in order to keep their position and hold their job, they've got to train the people that the elite rulers are the best thing that there is. If they don't do that, they're going to lose their position. And so there's an agenda. Some elite group determines the curriculum. And so that's what is forced upon the many. When the state, the one, clearly is threatened by an external force, then the many are obligated to lay down their lives. At that point, you are obligated. So now we're seeing precedence here as to, well, who takes precedence? Well, there's the one. It's truly threatened by an aggressive outside force. Now the many will lay down their lives to protect the nation, to keep it a sovereign nation. But once again, God's law word must be turned to in order to establish the parameters of this war. Who is to fight? Only the men are to fight. What are the conditions of fighting? What are the objectives? What are the goals? What are the way you fight? All these kinds of things have to be determined by God's law. So it's a just war. It's a war of self-defense. It's not an aggressive expansion war. And so then the many can lay down their lives in those parameters, but not just because the state decides, well, we're going to go to war with country X because whatever our own political agenda is, or we don't like their ideas. They cannot call on the many to lay down their lives for that. The state cannot demand the many to lay down their lives for just any cause the state deems necessary. So in a just war situation, the one is to be preserved at the expense of the many, which shows that it's impossible to properly uphold the equal ultimacy of the one and the many without the detailed revelation of God's law, which showing us exactly what upholding equal ultimacy is. So you've got many churches today who reject the law of God as applicable, but they'll be holding to the one and the many, the triune God, and they'll say, yes, we get our understanding of this from the Trinity, but the truth is they do not know how to uphold the equal ultimacy of the one and the many without the law of God. All we're going to revert to is another version of Plato's picture. Or anarchy. One of those versions we're going to come up with. You put aside the law of God, you're at sea with respect to showing the equal ultimacy of the one and the many, because you need the law to show us where one boundary stops and the other one takes over, where one takes precedence and where the other one has to submit to the other one. So Plato's ideas about the one and the many failed. However, the modern state is in many ways trying to copy Plato, and failure is everywhere present. The problem, though, is that the modern church despises the law of God, and thus, although she grasps the triune nature of God, she doesn't know what this means for the details of life. We indeed have a great responsibility as we look in our day, as we seek to train our children, our families, in this way, realizing the responsibility is for them to understand the equal ultimacy of these things, but the only way to do that is through the law. So therefore, the understanding of the law is vital to our lives, to how we exist. And we need to apply that to every area of life. And as we've looked at the personal life, we've looked at family life, we've looked at marriage, we've looked at the church, with this one and the many principle being played out time and time again and again in the state. And it's in each case, we saw that it's only the law of God that shows us how the one and the many relate together. And so may the Lord continue to open our eyes to the importance of the subject and help us to grow in our ability to apply it to the different spheres that we're involved in, our families and through the state. Are there any questions or comments?
God-given ability to try and overthrow it.
Indeed. My understanding of that is once again bound by the whole of Scripture and what God has shown, and I believe what we find when we study that out in detail is that there are always lesser magistrates. Even when you had the king as supreme, there was always other recognized bodies of authority. So I believe when God is raising up a people to do that, I believe he has positions and people in positions of authority who are going to join together with the masses. So it's never just chaos. It's not the French Revolution where you've just got a rabble-rousing group throwing everything off and then, well, now what? There's just authority that are recognized authority people who are ready to step into positions of authority. And so then you throw off that with recognized other authorities. So those are checks that you would need to have. If you were in a country where you did not have a legitimate authority that could step into the position of the authority you're trying to overthrow, then I would say you would have to interpret that as God saying, you're not equipped.
Could we look at Bonhoeffer?
I believe Bonhoeffer was a legitimate attempt for the reason that opposition party had recognized leaders all ready to step into place. And a lot of them were killed because they didn't know if Hitler was gone yet. But to have waited to find out, they would have lost the initiative, so they had to reveal their hand and start to move into positions of authority. And then Hitler wasn't dead and the whole thing, but they had already exposed themselves. So I think they were very courageous. I think they were doing it in the right way. And I would have stood wholeheartedly behind them had I been alive then. So I think Bonhoeffer did the right thing. As a Christian, as a pastor, I think he was right on track with being involved in that. And that's a real check and balance because, you know, who knows, at some stage in the history of this nation, people might come to you and say, hey, we need to do something radical. And you say, well, if God hasn't raised up proper leaders in positions of authority, you know, we have no position. We need to have our thinking sharpened in these areas because, you know, life can change very quickly and we need to know how to respond or how to counsel.
Then the lesser magistrates not just have an option but a duty.
Right, and a tyrant is destroying the one as well as the tyrant is destroying the many, and so the lesser magistrate on two accounts has a responsibility to protect the people under him. That's what God raised him up for, is protection. And he's got to protect the nation. So he should step into the gap. And anybody who doesn't, either through fear or his own private agenda, is failing in his calling. Why we need to know these things is because the window of opportunity passes in a flash. And you've missed that opportunity and it's gone. But there's many other issues in our lives on lesser levels where we need to be equipped and prepared, and that's why I'd encourage you again, the young men, that, you know, the time that you have now, don't squander it, because there's going to be many decisions that are thrown upon you, and decisions for yourself, your family, for your nation, that you're going to be required to make, and it's going to set you on a direction. And you can look back and complain for years later on of missed opportunities, and how you're suffering now because of that, but to be equipped and ready to make those decisions is an important part of our calling.